American writer Rosalind Robinson is an award-winning novelist on a very grand scale. She won the Orange Prize in 2009 for her novel Home. In 2005, she won a Pulitzer for her novel Gilead. And her debut novel, published back in 1980, Housekeeping, was shortlisted for a Pulitzer. She's also written a number of non-fiction works. In fact, she's published more non-fiction than novels. Her non-fiction writing ranges from the political to the spiritual, and much of it is imbued with her Christian beliefs. Her new book of essays is called When I Was a Child, I Read Books, and she joins me now from her office at Iowa University. Marilyn, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much. Great to be here.
Well, it's lovely to have you on board. Now, I should say that this collection is more than just about your childhood reading. It's about your influences, your interests, your view on American political life. But I would like to take you back to your childhood. You grew up in Idaho, and you say this fact about you surprises some people. To those of us who don't know Idaho, can you explain that surprise?
Well, Idaho is a western state. It's in the Rocky Mountains. It's west of the Rocky Mountains. Most Americans can't even find it on a map. It's the same size, it's virtually the same size as England. We'll give you a sense of how it is geographically. It has a very small population. I think it just passed 1 million people. Two-thirds of it is public land that's owned either by the state or by the federal government. So there are huge areas of wilderness. For some reason, people just sort of forget that it exists, you know, and it's like being from with all respect to Timbuktu, about which I know nothing, it's like being from Timbuktu, you know.
Well, actually, it's sort of beautiful. It's to be in the spot that people don't notice. I mean, you've got a lovely quote. You say, one woman on Learning of My Origins said, but there has to be talent somewhere in the family.
It's very strange how these prejudices are so powerful. I can vouch for the fact that through my entire life, I have been dealing with the fact that Idaho is a strange place to be from.
Well, it seems to have served you all right. You felt that you were a writer long before you were published, you say.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Thank goodness, because I took my time getting published.
I suppose that's right. So you walk into a library and you look at the books and you think what?
Well, as an adult, I walk into a library and I have to fight the impulse to say to myself, the world doesn't need any more books, you know. But when I was a child, I felt as if there was some sort of kinship between me and books, even though I had no idea where they came from, how they were made. I just felt as if I belonged there and I could do that, you know.
Did you have that experience in your teenage years of going into a library and experiencing existential despair, of thinking there are too many books and my mind just isn't big enough?
No.
Oh, you didn't? I did. That was a big thing for me at university, and I've been an academic as you are, and I've had many students come to me with that sense that, gee, there's just too much to know.
Well, I mean, in a sense, that certainly is true, and I spend a great deal of time ordering books. I have a great collection of books that will be terrific reading whenever I have a chance to read them, you know. But it's so wonderful. It is such a fantastic wealth.
You've got to avoid that self-delusion, don't you, that if you put a book on your bookcase that you have somehow read it by a kind of spooky osmosis.
Yes. Well, I consider the books on my shelf to be my super ego, you know, my best self, what I really want to be someday.
Oh, I see. Yes. Yes, you're standing in front of your bookcase thinking, yeah, that could be me.
How I would admire myself if I had read that book.
You should be careful. Do you remember that scene in The Cherry Orchard where Uncle Gayov gives the speech to the dresser as though, he's solving the problems of the world? There's a kind of little warning there. Let's talk about how Idaho has shaped your view of the world. You say that Idahos don't have a sense of social class. How does that show itself?
Well, you know, I wrote that on the basis of childhood memory, and I'm afraid that's an aspect of Idaho civilization that may have eroded because it became very fashionable for people to buy big pieces of land in underpopulated states like Montana and Idaho. And that by itself, you know, the sort of mega wealth moving into the wilderness, you know, it's changed the quality of things. Those places used to be left very much to the people that were willing to be remote from most of the civilization and do a great deal for themselves and forego many things, you know. I think one of the reasons that there was so much reading around me is because books are so relatively easily transportable as cultural objects go.
It's a mountainous state, a small population, as you say, a place of spectacular beauty. I guess it's one of those places in America where it is easy to believe in the idea that Americans are people with a manifest destiny, that God has somehow blessed them, touched them. Did you feel that?
Well, not as being something specific to America. I think the sense that I had of the world had everything to do with mountains and forests and glacial lakes and solitude and wildflowers and all that sort of thing. But for me, that was the world, you know. And I felt very much as if God's attention to it would be quite a natural thing, his pleasure in it also, I should say.
I want to explore that a little more, and it seems to me that an important insight you've got here is the special meaning you say the word lonesome has in that part of the country.
Yes. Yes. It's a strange thing. My brother and I talk about this sometimes because we were brought up with that as an ideal, really. You know, I was told by a teacher of mine, you have to give yourself a mind that you want to live with because you're going to live with it your whole life, you know, which is not bad advice. But I, you know, it was just in the culture of my family and my grandparents and so on that the ideal thing was to be happily alone. And I have frankly explored this worldview at some length, and I think it is one interesting way to live a life.
But you say it's a characteristic of that part of the country, that the word lonesome has positive connotations. It's not just your family. It's sort of in the community, is it?
Well, yes. Yes. I mentioned my family simply because I was the fourth generation of my family to live in that place. And so the local culture and my family culture were pretty, deeply mingled.
And has that sensibility, that sense of lonesomeness and of country and of coming from a place that, you know, other people don't know, has it infused your fiction? Do you think it's shaped the way you approach the world and the way you approach your relationship with God?
I think there's no question that it has. The early memories that we have, the early experiences of the world that we have, I think are necessarily very formative, more deeply so than we actually can ever be aware. But when I left Idaho to go to a college in Rhode Island at an Ivy League college, Brown, and that was when I first encountered this amazement that one would have come from Idaho, you know. And I was starting to write then. I was taking creative writing courses, actually. And I would write about Idaho just because it fascinated me to try to evoke a sense of the place. And so over the early years that I was writing, that was a very great subject for me. You know, what did it look like? What did it feel like? And why was it, you know, a lovely, if lonely, place to be?
And were you motivated to write about that because you were somewhere so different? There you are, as you say, on Rhode Island in an elite university. You're this improbable woman from Idaho that apparently doesn't produce people who go to elite universities. Is that why you're searching for a way of telling that story?
Well, yes. Also, I mean, I must say that my brother was at the same university. He was 3 years ahead of me, but we were both there. But in any case, there's a sort of I mean, a good part of my first novel, Housekeeping, I actually wrote in France. And the difference between France and Idaho isn't absolute, but it comes close, you know? And that's very sensitizing. It really is. It makes you really realize how your mind is stored with a certain world of memory, you know, when you're over against something that, you know, that the difference is continuously stimulated, you know?
Yeah, I understand that. That sense of going away in order to know who you are is quite powerful, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
This is Books and Arts Daily on RN, and I'm talking to Marilyn Robinson, who's talking to us from her office at Iowa University. And we're talking to her not because she's written a novel. This time she's back with a book of essays, which is called When I Was a Child, I Read Books. And she's reflecting on lots of aspects of her life, and in particular, where her fiction comes from. I guess that's a way of putting it. Marilyn, I'm interested in the way geography shapes our core values. In the US, the journey west, the journey away from coastal settlements, is for America at large a kind of journey into Eden. I mean, just by way of conversation, in Australia, the journey west is a journey into aridity and disappointment. You know, we end up in a desert, whereas the Americans end up on the Great Plains. And I suspect that leaves us with very different core values. So I want to come back to that question I put to you at the start about whether it's easier or no, perhaps not easier, but the sense of God, the sense of his presence, the sense of his having a plan is made manifest when you are living amid forests and mountains and great lakes.
Well, yes, I think that's true, although frankly, you know, Jesus was fond of the desert. And John the Baptist, and God knows how many others.
But then to pull you up on that, the word wilderness in the Jesus story, which evokes going into the wilderness and standing in the desert, evokes a different term from what Americans mean by wilderness. If you say wilderness to an American, by and large, it means, well, it means going to Idaho, doesn't it?
Yes. Yes. Well, it's, you know, it's an amazing thing that this population has had access to this part of the continent. You know, it's a when you travel west, it's almost you know, every stage in the trip west after you get past the Great Plains, and the Great Plains are wonderful in their own way, but it becomes more and more sort of fabulous as you go along, you know, and then get to a place like Salt Lake City, and there, you know, are mountains that you really almost can't believe that, you know, that they're great presences on the landscape. And so as you go farther, you know, the Olympic Peninsula and all that beautiful coastal, you know, region with the wonderful trees and so on, it's kind of fabulous. It is like some sort of hyperbole that keeps building on itself, you know. I think that one of the things that Americans just love to do is cross the continent because it's so amazing.
Yes, well, it's so interesting to me that the journey of Lewis and Clark, the iconic American explorers, is a journey into sort of wonderland, whereas so many of the Australian explorers are actually journeying into death.
That's, you know, that's sad. You know what I mean? All I can say is that for the most part, at least know enough to enjoy this wonderful good fortune.
Yeah. Let's talk about fiction. You talk about why we need fiction, and you posit that there is some fiction that can be spoken of as true and some which is false. You write, if a time comes when I seem not to be making the distinction with some degree of reliability in my own work, I hope someone will be kind enough to let me know. Can we talk about this? Because on the face of it, it seems paradoxical to say that some fiction can be spoken of as true.
Yes, I know. It's very paradoxical. It certainly is. And I, some things I just consider to be intractably mysterious. But I think anybody has the experience sometimes of picking up a novel and feeling that there's something feigned or spurious or whatever the word would be, that it's not coming from the center of the writer's mind or from the center of her experience. And It's hard to explain that, but it feels like a lie. And it feels like an insult in the same way it is to be bald-facedly lied to, you know?
Yes, and the sense that the novel is somehow taking us beyond the appearance of things to the really real.
Yes. Yes. One of the things that definitely has to be taught, encouraged in young writers, and of course I teach young writers, is to be sure they're not following a convention. You know, that a certain kind of book will sell well, and then you have to tell them then that can't be your model, you know. You have to think it over again. You have to do something out of yourself. They can't be good writers until they can learn to do that.
One of the impressions that comes out of reading your essays as a totality is that you feel as though your fiction and your religious faith somehow share a common source. Am I reading you correctly in that?
Well, you know, I think that's true. I'm always a little baffled by the idea of religious faith, in a sense, because I know that that my interior world, my intellectual world and everything else is deeply imbued with, you know, Christian theology and metaphysics and so on, because I love that and I've been studying it for years. But sometimes people talk about faith as if it were an affiliation, you know, as if it were something that you basically applied yourself to or strove after, or something like that. I study, you know, Christian theology and history and so on because I'm feeding an interest that very strongly pre-exists in me, you know. I can't really imagine that I would be able to depart from that, because it's a very, very important, it's my metaphysics. It's how I actually do see reality. So it's more than faith in a certain sense, in the sense that it's more determining and pervasive, I think, than faith is often thought of as being.
Yes, and I suppose faith is also sometimes prescriptive. There are things one has to believe in order to qualify, whereas the way you write is much more mysterious or much more open to dwelling with uncertainty.
Yes. Yes, I think that that human beings have a tendency toward narrowness, and that inevitably this has influenced religious thought over millennia, you know, it simply has to be more mysterious, more undefined than
yes,
many people assume.
Can I put it to you another way and see whether you agree with this? I think that the issue is that often religion is cast in terms of a binary universe in which there are the saved and the unsaved, the virtuous and the sinful, those who are in and those who are out. And that kind of binary thinking always reduces life to simplicities, because in the end it's about the people who are good and the people who are the enemies who have to be fought. It somehow closes down our capacity for compassion and empathy with people who are not like us.
And, you know, that is so perverse. It is so unbiblical. You know, it's amazing to me that people who claim to be acquainted with that text can be so fiercely self-righteous and judgmental, as they very often are. It's this whole good-bad dichotomy, you know. There's really nothing in the Bible that justifies the presumption of making those kinds of distinctions.
Well, those who are not for me are against me. That's pretty binary, isn't it?
Well, it depends on what for me means.
Yes, I suppose. Yes.
I mean, because, you know, a lot of those people that Jesus speaks to, he clearly considers, Pharisees. I mean, people that are self-righteous and punctilious about minor things and you know, completely misled about major things and so on. I don't think there's anything simple about the idea of being for him.
Can we move on and look at some of the, or one of the other issues you've covered in the essays? You've written an essay called Austerity as Ideology, which is a very eye-catching title at this time of austerity. We're seeing, you know, these elections in France and in Greece. In Australia today, it's budget time, so we're looking at an austerity budget here. Can you talk to me a bit about what you mean when you talk about austerity as an ideology?
Well, you know, when I read about these things that are happening in... you know, in Europe especially, here also, of course. But they always, they talk as if there are, you know, economic indicators that if they indicate difficulties with a budget or whatever, should be simply able to overwhelm politics, history, social accommodation, you know. And the assumption, I was reading, of course, about the elections in France, the assumption that they say is governing the market, is that someone whose politics are like Hollande cannot run a good economy, you know? And this is as much an ideological decision as it is any other kind. I mean, during the time of our prosperity, that was exactly the time in which the governments were not austere, you know? The same people who stand on the sidelines and tremble whenever anybody proposes anything that would be socially beneficial are exactly the same people who crashed the global economy.
Yes, they've been profligate in times of plenty and are now demanding an austerity at the time when it might be said we now need to invest.
Exactly, and the austerity always falls on other people, you know? I mean, these people are always speaking in ways that would benefit themselves and harm people who are vulnerable. It's very disturbing.
Are you an optimistic person?
Well, I am. I am. I think that people do a lot of things that are somewhere between stupid and disastrous. I think history bears that out. But there's the other side also, you know. Our humane impulses prevail from time to time.
Well, the question always is, where do we look for hope?
Yes, well, I think that we have to reestablish very basic respect for human beings as such. I mean, that, you know, you can't argue that it's beneficial to disable a generation of people, you know, educationally and nutritionally and all the rest of it, and then say that there's some better good that waits on the other side of that. If you're harming people, that's purely negative, you know, and everything has to be based around that. Otherwise, we get homicidal, you know, and pernicious in various ways.
Well, Marilyn, that's a challenging spot to end, but we do need to stop. Thank you so much for joining us. It's been lovely to talk to you.
Well, thank you. I've enjoyed it too.
Marilyn Robinson, her latest collection of essays is called When I Was a Child, I Read Books, and it's published by Virago. This is Books and Arts Daily on RN.